MacCast, Thursday, January 5th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast in a brand new year. It is 2017. Happy New Year. I hope you had a fabulous, wonderful New Year and a great holiday. Maybe got to spend some time with family and friends, which is certainly something I did. Took a little time off, but I am happy to be back here with you in a brand new year to cover all things Apple and Macintosh. And boy, do we got a lot of things to discuss. This always happens when I miss or take any kind of time off. There ends up being a backup of stories. We're going to try and rush through. It's not the right thing to say. We're going to try and get through all of this stuff and hopefully not take up too much of your time. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple's expansion into Asia, what's happening with the latest iPhone rumors, because we should get a new iPhone in 2017. A little update on Apple's AI research. Going to talk about AirPods and possible battery issues. Consumer Reports, a little more information on their whole battery thing. And possibly a new mode coming in iOS, though I'm not so sure about that. And then going to get into some of your feedback. I'm going to mention, you know, my thoughts and opinions on the new TV app a little bit. Had some time to play around with that, and I have some opinions on it. So I'm going to share my opinions with you. We're also going to talk about mesh networks and Wi-Fi. A lot of people asking questions about that. It's kind of a hot new item. CES is going on right now, and there's some of those products coming out from various router vendors. We're moving away from routers into these mesh products. So we're going to talk about that. I'm going to talk more about AirPods and what happens if you lose or maybe if someone tries to steal them. And then some issues for someone with international iCloud services. And we're going to get into that and give some tips and tricks as well. So lots of great things to get into. Let's just dive right into it, shall we? The Economic Daily News claims that Foxconn is going to help Apple expand their operations into Indonesia and China. The report doesn't expand too much on exactly what they're going to be doing, what kinds of assistance they're going to be giving Apple beyond claiming that Foxconn is providing Apple access to their partners and suppliers in the region. So this is not Apple expanding with Foxconn, but rather Apple wanting to get more partners in those regions and Foxconn sort of helping them set up the arrangements. Now, previously, the Indonesian Communication and Information Minister had announced that they were completing plans with Apple for a new research center in Jakarta. So it seems like we've heard a lot about expansion into those regions for R&D efforts. As a matter of fact, earlier last year, it was reported that Apple was also developing its first research and development center in Beijing, though that report somewhat conflicts with an Economic Daily News report claiming that Apple was actually constructing a new R&D center in Shenzhen for 2017. So I don't know if that means they're going to have facilities in both locations or if sort of one and the other or the other, and they were trying to decide between that. Reuters also reported recently that Apple would invest $44 million over the next 3 years in R&D centers in India. So Apple vastly expanding their R&D facilities. Now, note that all of these reports are for R&D facilities, and the rumor of Foxconn helping Apple has them looking into expanding their manufacturing facilities outside of China into places including India and the U.S. In fact, it's also been recently reported in the Wall Street Journal that Apple has requested some incentives from the Indian government for moving some of its manufacturing to India. Two of the incentives that were requested were subsidies for building plants in India and an exemption from a requirement to print product information on their devices. The Times of India cited recent job listings also by Apple, one for an iPhone operations manager in India, as evidence that Apple will partner with and open some sort of facility in the region in April. So Apple expanding efforts outside of China, and that includes the U.S. If you remember, we talked a little bit about Apple possibly moving to the U.S., and they had asked Foxconn for some help and in looking into facilities in the U.S., and also asked their partner Pegatron for a similar thing, although Pegatron had declined. So sort of what I'm taking away from these reports is that Apple is looking to move manufacturing out of China, and a lot of people might be wondering, well, why are they doing that? And there is a couple of reasons. There's also a couple reasons why they might not want to move out of China. And as a matter of fact, DigiTimes has a report stating that if Apple did move manufacturing out of China into the US or maybe other locations like India, Indonesia, all these places that they're supposedly looking into, that could be a problem for Apple because a lot of the Chinese supply chain would not follow Apple into those regions. And they give a number of reasons for that. Specifically looking at the U.S., they cite the fact that the workforce in the U.S. is largely over 45 years old. And for those manufacturing jobs, they tend to like younger workers. They also cite, of course, higher labor costs as a concern for Chinese companies moving outside of China and maybe following Apple. Although they do note that power and land costs are cheaper in the U.S. The reality is, though, that none of these things would really matter and wouldn't, in my opinion, really affect whether Apple moved out of China or not. Most of Apple's core component suppliers, specifically for the iPhone, are actually not in China. The largest portion is in Japan, about 32%, almost 33%. Then there's almost 29% in the U.S., 19% in Taiwan. Other Asian areas is 7.5%, and then Europe is 6.5%. So really, I don't see that as potentially being a problem. Now, the DigiTimes piece gives an example of molding metal components to order that can happen much quicker because some of those suppliers are in China, in Shenzhen. They say it would take about 10 days, but it could possibly take as long as a month in the U.S. But Apple really manages their supply chain and they know what's going on. So they could very easily, I think, account for that. There's several factors. If you're wondering, you know, why does Apple or why would Apple even be looking at moving out of China? They've been doing so well there with their manufacturing. Well, there's a lot of factors that actually make moving more manufacturing out of China more likely. China, their government is actually reducing incentives and tightening requirements and concessions on any products made by foreign companies who want to manufacture in China. So it's getting tighter. They're not giving as many subsidies. There's not as many incentives happening. And it's just because their manufacturing has matured to that point. They've got a growing middle class and it's changing. This is the same sort of changes that happened during the industrial ages in many other countries, including the U.S. There are actually more affordable workforces now in other regions, places like India and Brazil. And also, more robots are coming into the manufacturing. So the labor force is less of a draw or a, I guess, factor in whether or not, you know, or where Apple might do their manufacturing. As a matter of fact, according to a DigiTimes report, Foxconn, Apple's main manufacturing partner, has already replaced almost 60,000 workers in their plants with what they're calling Foxbots, with robots. And they actually have a three-phase strategy for getting to an almost fully automated factory using robots and minimal production workers. As a matter of fact, the report says that they already have 10 fully automated production lines at several factories. So if you're looking at an automated workforce, mostly of robots, and you look at the fact that power and land costs are actually cheaper in the U.S., it doesn't seem that crazy to think that Apple may want to move some manufacturing back here and to other places throughout the world. So I think we're going to see Apple and Apple's partners really diversifying where they're doing manufacturing. And a lot of these reports, that's why we're seeing them crop up right now. So in my opinion, that's kind of what's going on. If you've read or heard anything different or want to give me a little feedback, certainly shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Of course, a big part of what Apple will be manufacturing is iPhones, and the iPhone 7, 7S, 7S Plus, 8 rumors continue to flow in, including a rumor that the iPhone cameras, their dual-lens camera, may go vertical in 2017. This rumor comes via Mac Takara and the Taiwanese supply chain. The rumor is a bit odd because it claims, like others, that Apple will add a third-sized iPhone to its lineup, but unlike others, they claim that this is going to be a mid-sized 5-inch model. So we had been hearing from other rumors that there was going to be this high-end OLED curved glass iPhone, 5.1 to 5.8 inches, although more of the reports seemed to be leaning toward that larger 5.8 inch size. I guess in some ways the rumor coming from Mac Takara does line up with earlier statements by Ming-Chi Kuo, who reported that Apple was working on a 5.1 or 5.2 inch display. Though this rumor also says that the design and specifications for the first two phones would be identical to the current design, 4.7 inches and 5.5 inches, and they claim that those models would actually be labeled as the iPhone 7S and the iPhone 7S Plus. And the assumption is that then this new model, this curved OLED glass model, regardless of whatever size it might be, would actually be the rumored iPhone 8 model coming out in 2017. Now, this report also does claim, as I alluded to, that Apple would change the orientation of the dual lens array on that top of the line model from horizontal to vertical, but they don't explain why that would be. So something I'm planning on trying to look into is there a difference between how you orient those lenses? Does it make a difference? If you happen to be a photographer and you know about this stuff, shoot me an email, let me know, because I'm really curious. Why would you switch it around? Maybe it's just for moving components. And again, they didn't get into it in this report, so I'm going to have to do my own digging on this one. But the display discrepancy in size may also be related to this idea that there's going to be curved glass on the higher-end iPhone and that it's going to be an edge-to-edge design. So if you look at the size of the current iPhone and you sort of drop a 5.8-inch piece of glass or, you know, fake piece of glass on top of it, what you notice is that you wind up with about 7.2 millimeters on each side. And the 5.5-inch screen on the iPhone 7 Plus, or the iPhone 7 Plus is actually, the width of it is 68 millimeters wide, and the device is, guess what, 7.3 millimeters thick. So you have 7.3 and 7.3 on each side for the height of the phone. You wrap that around, and you could fit a 5.8-inch screen, which would be 82.5 millimeters on that, and still get the same form factor or size as an iPhone 7 Plus. So Ming-Chi Kuo seemed to be alluding to the fact that the 5.2 inches would be actually the size of the display, and then the other parts of the glass would sort of wrap around. The question becomes, is that going to be some sort of usable area of display? It's not really clear at this point, but it's seeming like it would not, that you'd actually have more of a 5-inch display. So I guess overall display size would actually be slightly smaller than the 5.5-inch iPhone. Again, these rumors are kind of odd and out there. I would think what Apple would want to do is have a similar size screen or active area to the iPhone 7 Plus, but actually bring down the form factor or size a little bit, but maybe not. I mean, people seem to like big phones. So I'm all a little bit confused about what's going on here. Hopefully, before this summer when Apple announces, or this fall rather, when Apple announces the phone, we can maybe make sense of all of this. You know, it's early in the rumor mill, so chances are a lot of the stuff we're seeing and hearing about right now is prototypes, Apple playing around with different designs, different screen sizes. This is what they always do. They should be moving into starting to line up manufacturing partners and things like that, so they're going to have to solidify some of these things. And hopefully when that's happening, things will kind of solidify in the rumor mill as well. As far as who's going to be making these screens, recent reports have claimed that Samsung might be the sole supplier of at least the new OLED displays. They can reportedly supply Apple with about 20 million OLED displays per month, and estimates are that Apple would sell between 60 to 70 million units of the new higher-end OLED iPhone 8 in 2017. So that kind of lines up. It also sort of explains why Apple might reserve the OLED display just for the top-of-the-line model. For assembly, another DigiTimes report is claiming that Apple may add a third manufacturing partner. Apple has for a long time always used Foxconn and Pegatron as their main assembly partners for the iPhone, but now DigiTimes is claiming that Apple may add Wistron as a third manufacturer. And actually, Wistron, they're best known most recently for being the manufacturer of Apple's new AirPods. So it would make sense for them to branch out, especially if they're going to go with three different models. So it may be that Wistron or one of the other manufacturers gets the iPhone 7S, iPhone 7S Plus, and then Foxconn or Pegatron. Most likely Foxconn is going to be ramping up and really assembling the higher end model. How it will break out, we really don't know. I'm just kind of speculating, thinking out loud in my head right now. A few other recent iPhone 7 and iPhone 8 rumors. Talking with The Verge ahead of CES, the CEO of Energys, who has been rumored to be working with Apple on a quote-unquote true wireless charging technology, says that his company will be shipping their technology by the end of 2017. Their transmitters reportedly are currently capable of charging wirelessly devices up to several feet away. Don't have exact distances, but you don't have to be right on a charging pad, which is one of the rumors that Apple has been trying to get that technology into the next version of the iPhone. Now, in 2015, the company did discuss and show off their technology. I don't know if they showed it off. They at least talked about it at CES, and they were actually getting ready to launch it. It was expected that it might be out in 2016, but supposedly after CES, a quote, key strategic partnership was formed with a company that asked them to, one, miniaturize the technology, and also give this strategic partner the exclusive rights to ship the first product with the Energys technology in it. And I guess they said yes, and now Apple is rumored to be that partner. And in this interview, the CEO made it sound even more like this might be a partnership with Apple. He wouldn't say exactly who it was when pressed, but he did claim that it was, quote, one of the largest consumer electronic companies in the world, end quote, and that most people have this company's products in their pocket, on their desks, or in their home. So tantalizing indeed. I think it would be great if Apple had the first shipping product with this technology in it. Hopefully it works really well. That would be my concern, is what's the charging rate? How does it work? Well, even if it doesn't work great, it could be great for just, you know, leaving overnight and slowly charging up your device, especially since one of our other favorite leakers, Sonny Dixon, recently spoke to Forbes and claims that the new models will actually have fast charging in them thanks to a new TriStar 3 Hydra chip. He doesn't go into a lot of details, or he didn't get a lot of details on specifically how the fast charging would work, what it would be compatible with, all those sorts of things. So there's a lot of questions out there, but the idea would be that for wired charging, so it's sounding like we're still going to have a Lightning connector, maybe USB-C connector. I would think that this would be the time for Apple to switch, but, you know, giving up that lucrative licensing for Lightning may not be something they want to do quite yet, but supposedly, our charging will be faster, according to Sonny, with these new models. He also reiterated the fact that there would be three models, an iPhone 7S, an iPhone 7S Plus, and the iPhone 8. And finally, he said that that top-of-the-line model exclusively would get a new tap-to-wake feature. That sounds a little bit odd to me. I'm not sure why Apple would limit tap-to-wake just to the highest-end model of iPhone. This is a feature I've wanted for a really long time. As a matter of fact, because I have tap, you know, what essentially becomes tap-to-wake on my Apple Watch, I'm constantly trying to do the whole tap-to-wake thing on my iPhone. I'd love to be able to just tap the screen and get access to my notifications. The raise-to-wake is kind of nice, and I guess somewhat solves that problem, but I think I'd rather opt for tap-to-wake. So I may have to get a new larger iPhone 8 to actually get that feature, at least if Sonny Dixon's rumors turn out to be true. And then the last rumor for iPhones is iPhone 7. We've had these rumors about the iPhone 7 that, you know, we got the cool jet black model. There'd been these rumors that surfaced that maybe Apple was going to do a jet white version of that iPhone. And that rumor was rekindled this week thanks to a post on the official Beats Instagram page. They posted this image that looked like, or it was actually showing off a pair of black studio wireless headphones, but sitting right next to them was something that looks suspiciously like a white iPhone 7 and a maybe glossy white iPhone 7. Now, again, we first heard about these rumors of a white iPhone 7 through mumblings from Mac Attakara back in November, and then that was followed up by Sonny Dixon again posting a video of what was supposedly white rear iPhone 7 casings. It wasn't clear if those were official Apple ones or, you know, just ones being manufactured out of China, but they were there. And so everybody's been kind of crazy about, hey, wouldn't it be cool since we have this cool glossy black, jet black iPhone if we had a white version of that. And I agree, it would be incredibly amazing. But before we get all excited, not so fast, Apple Insider did note of that image that was on the Instagram, the Beats Instagram, what really looked like to be happening was probably a trick of the Instagram filters on a silver iPhone. It caused it to kind of be washed out and really end up looking like a white iPhone. So they did a little Photoshop magic on it and said, no, it's probably just a silver, a standard silver iPhone 7. So, you know, who knows? Maybe Apple will do a white version for 2017 in that iPhone 8. Only time will tell. And then, you know, patently Apple, this is not something that's being rumored for the next generation iPhone, but patently Apple uncovered some patent applications where Apple has been exploring or filed for patents of devices having digital crowns other than Apple Watches, things like iPhones and tablets. And in one of these implementations, they show this cube-like home screen that would actually rotate into different categories of applications as you twisted the digital crown on your iPhone or your iPad. Now, Ben Lovejoy over at 9 to 5 Mac said he loves this idea and he's been wanting a digital crown on his iPhone for a while. But I don't know. I'm not buying it. What do you think? To me, it doesn't provide nearly enough benefit. I mean, we could have a cube-like home screen. I think that's kind of cool where you have different launchers maybe organized by categories, and every time you swipe, they rotate around. But that's really just an animation on top of maybe the app screens that we have already. I already kind of organize my apps into different categories. So I can do that with a swipe or some other gesture. And I really think sticking a, you know, this button, this digital crown on the side of the iPhone really would kind of ruin the aesthetic. So I don't get the draw, but it's out there. Apple's obviously thought about it, or at least thought about protecting that idea with a patent. What do you think? Now, I don't think it's a really big thing. And then as far as, you know, what Apple has in terms of iPhone sales right now, well, Apple may need a boost from this upcoming iPhone 8 to impress their investors and Wall Street. There was a report this week that came out that claims sluggish global sales of the iPhone 7, that the iPhone 7 kind of came out with a bang, but it slowed down drastically, causing Apple to actually reduce production of iPhone 7, 10% in the first part of this year. Some feel that Apple didn't capitalize enough on the Samsung Galaxy fiasco to take advantage of that. Others are saying that it's the lack of compelling new features in the iPhone 7 that have resulted in lower than expected demand, though I'm not so sure I'm actually buying this report. This is typical of what Apple does. They really ramp up production in the lead up to a new device. They keep that production level pretty high through the holiday season so that they make sure they have a good supply. And as a matter of fact, even in this same report, there are claims that Apple really hasn't been able to keep up with demand for the iPhone 7 Plus, and mostly due to shortages of the new camera sensors. So, you know, Apple is actually selling a lot of iPhones, and there's a lot of evidence of that. And I really think this reduction in production, hey, that rhymes, reduction in production is actually just part of the normal cycle. We're moving into the stage where Apple's going to continue to sell iPhones at a pretty good rate, but it's not going to match the initial launch quantities or the holiday quantities that they would have needed. So I think this is just a normal drawdown in production, but we'll keep an eye on it. You know, we'll see how Apple's quarterly numbers go. I have a feeling the first quarter numbers are going to be great. They always really are, but everybody's just really worried about, you know, iPhone sales, and is it on this downward trend? So anytime you see any change in Apple's sort of production of iPhones, people kind of freak out. But I don't think there's anything to worry about here. And especially with a brand new model, brand new design coming in 2017, I think it's going to be a pretty good year for Apple when it comes to the iPhone. And maybe providing a little more evidence to the fact that Apple is doing okay with the iPhone is a report from Flurry Analytics that came out recently. They claim that Apple had twice as many device activations over the holiday as its nearest competitor, Samsung. Flurry claims that Apple saw an amazing 44% of all device activations over the holiday. And the data also showed that consumers continue to be moving toward the larger screen devices, with 37% of the activations being for what they call phablets, what I call gigantophones, the big phones, right? Though 45% were still for what they call medium phones, or we'll just say the iPhone 7 in this case. But last year, just 27% of the activations were for phablets and 54% for medium phone. So you're seeing quite a rise in, you know, that's 10% more activations this year on the larger screen phones. And then moving to tablets, their data does show that tablet activations have shrunk 23% since 2013. But the numbers for this year compared to last year also show that things are actually stabilizing for the tablet market. This year, tablet activations were at 18%, and that's just down 1% from 17% in 2015. So, yes, tablet activations and tablet sales continue to slow, but it's leveling out. And I think that's what we've been seeing with some of Apple's other numbers. But overall, it's looking like a pretty good holiday season for Apple this year, and it usually is, so not too surprising. I think one of my favorite things about Tim Cook's Apple, the new Apple under Tim Cook, is all of the things he's been doing outside the realm of what we traditionally think about when we think about Apple. So you think about Apple, you think about great products, great user experience, high level of secrecy around their products. All of those things still exist at Apple. They're still the core focuses of Apple. But there's other areas and realms, the social initiatives, the environmental concerns. All of these things, I think, are great things that Tim Cook has sort of pushed forward and pushed to the forefront in Apple. And some other changes that are being made that I think are positive are in the area of sort of giving back to the technology community. And in this case, the research community on stuff that Apple is developing. And the reason it's being done is in the past, Apple's researchers, people who come to work at Apple, working in R&D, working on technologies, they have been banned from actually publishing papers. And recently, it's sounding like those rules apparently have changed, at least for Apple's artificial intelligence researchers. And this is important because anybody in those fields, they want to be able to publish and talk about some of the work that they're doing. And so it's always been somewhat of a hindrance at Apple to get the very top best people, because a lot of those people want to be able to publish research papers. So it's sounding like Apple is loosening those restrictions, and that's probably going to be good. As long as they can kind of balance that with their security privacy stuff. But really part of the issue with this old policy was actually attracting, you know, the best people in the field. So hopefully this change is going to make a difference. And we saw recently the first research paper that was published and talked about. It was a research paper called Learning from Simulated and Unsupervised Images Through Adversarial Training. And you can probably go look up that paper if you want to get all the nitty-gritty and details. But basically what it outlines, it describes a program that can intelligently decipher and understand digital images. So you can probably assume, and I'm going to assume, that this was based on or comes from a lot of the technology that was built into Apple's new iCloud photo library, and more specifically, the image recognition, image tagging, facial recognition technologies that are in the latest version of Photos, both on iOS and on the Mac. So this is just another, I think, pretty cool change under the leadership of Tim Cook that's happening at Apple. They're also sort of opening up more, something that is important to me, they're opening up a little bit more on the PR side. And we're starting to get more details. We're hearing Apple talk to the press a little bit more. I don't think ever under Steve Jobs we would have seen the vice presidents and the CEO, you know, winding up on, well, I don't know if Tim Cook's wound up on a podcast yet, but certainly Phil Schiller and Craig Federighi and those guys, they've been on some podcasts now. So that's pretty impressive. That's a pretty big seed change and pretty exciting, I think, especially for someone like myself who happens to be a podcaster. If you've been following the launch of AirPods, you know, one, that they're incredibly hard to come by, although a little bit later in the show, I may be able to help you out with that. But two, that a lot of people really like them, and I'll include myself in that group. If you didn't hear my initial thoughts on the AirPods, you can go back and listen to the last episode of the MacCast, but they're pretty great. And all around, if you read a lot of the reviews, they're getting really good reviews. Probably one of the best products Apple put out in 2016. And yeah, that's maybe not saying much because they didn't put out a lot of new hardware in 2016, but pretty amazing. You know, they bring back that Apple magical experience in a lot of ways. But there may be one area where the AirPods are hitting a little speed bump. iDownload blog noted a Reddit thread of a number of AirPod owners complaining about battery issues. Some were reporting that the AirPods battery case was actually draining very rapidly while the AirPods were in there overnight. And that really shouldn't be happening. The idea behind the battery charging case is you charge it up, you use the AirPods, you can use them for up to, I think, 5 hours of listening time. And then when the battery, the little tiny battery in the AirPod is used up, you put it back in the case. And within 15 minutes, the AirPod will charge up to 100%. So what they're finding is that when you're leaving the AirPods in the case, it's going from 100% charge down to a much lower level just overnight. As a matter of fact, one person reported going from 100% to 50%, and he wasn't even using them. So it shouldn't be drawing that much power. Really, what should be happening is the AirPods should charge up to 100%, and then it'll sit there, and I'm sure it will cycle a little bit where the AirPod will discharge a little bit, and then it should charge back up. But that certainly shouldn't be pulling all that kind of battery out of the charging case. I've been kind of monitoring mine since I heard this report, and right after I read the report, I had my battery case charged up to 100%, and I noticed that the next morning, the battery level with the AirPods in there was down to 69%. So I thought, well, maybe there's something to this. But then I realized this was after I had actually been using the AirPods for about 3 to 4 hours and returning them to the case. So maybe that's normal. I don't know. Also, 3 hours after I checked that, I checked it again, and it was only down 68% to 68%. So only down 1% after 3 hours more usage of using the AirPods. And again, that was, I think, with the AirPods in the just sitting in the case. So I don't think I'm having that problem. Again, they should be cycling, but you shouldn't be seeing that much charging loss. If you're experiencing that large of a loss while the AirPods are in the case, it may be worth contacting Apple. There's probably not a lot of replacement units out there right now, so that's a concern of some people. But, you know, some Redditors who were having the problem did mention getting replacement units from Apple and saying that those replacement units did not exhibit the same problem. Now, anytime a new product comes out, there's going to be little speed bumps. There could potentially be manufacturing problems, small issues with software, things that might have to be tweaked. So I don't think this is a huge concern or a huge issue at this point. Some have also reported, though, that they've been able to fix the battery issues on their own by actually resetting the AirPods. And if you want to know how to do that, you take the AirPods, you put them in the battery case, and then you hold the setup button, the little button on the back of the case, for at least 15 seconds. Open up the case so you can see the status light. Hold that button down until you see it flashing amber. So when you first hold it down, it'll start flashing white. That's when it's trying to do the manual pairing. Continue to hold it down until you see an amber flashing light, and then it goes back to white flashing, and that will have reset your AirPods. After that, you're going to have to reconnect them to all of your devices, or at least to one device, and then sync it back through iCloud to your other devices, the connection. And then you should be good to go again. Also, if you changed the double tap function settings for Siri, if you maybe moved that to play pause, you're probably going to have to reset that again too, because again, resetting the AirPods kind of puts them back to factory. But if that fixes your battery problems with the charging case, it's probably worth doing. And as a matter of fact, I did that with my AirPods just to be safe. Others have reported that maybe doing a battery cycle of the charging case can help. So continue to use the charging case till it goes all the way down and it's fully drained, and fully drain the AirPods as well, and then recharge everything back up altogether. And just doing that power cycle might sort of reset things and get them back working again. But AirPods are pretty amazing, and they seem to be doing very well in terms of sales. As a matter of fact, Tim Cook was asked about them in a CNBC interview, and he wouldn't comment specifically, other than saying that Apple had a great holiday. He was actually in New York when he was sort of hunted down by CNBC. He was at the New York Stock Exchange actually showing his nephew around, and they grabbed him. And they asked him about, you know, Apple's holiday and how they were doing, and specifically about the AirPods, which he called a, quote, runaway success. And he claimed that Apple was making them, again, quote, as fast as they can. And in-store availability, you know, they may be making them as fast as they can, but they're also, I think, selling them as fast as they can. Because I checked in-store availability recently, and it still seemed to be reporting, like, February 22nd, about 6 weeks out for their inventory. You can occasionally, if you're trying to get your hands on some, find them in stock. You have to just keep checking the app, checking frequently, going to the store frequently. But stores are supposedly getting shipments on a periodic basis. They still seem to be selling out, though, very, very quickly. And according to an Economic Daily News report, Inventec, the company manufacturing AirPods, oh, I think I got that wrong earlier. I think I said that it was Wiston. Inventec, who's actually manufacturing Apple for, or AirPods for Apple, has been expanding their capacity to try and meet demand. They also say that their current plants are working overtime to try and deliver orders. So I know that some people got their AirPod orders early. Apple, I think, is manufacturing them as quickly as they can, but definitely a runaway success of a product, just like Tim Cook said. Moving back to batteries, this time the MacBook Pro battery. You may remember we talked a little bit about the Consumer Reports review of the new MacBook Pros that was the first time they said they could not recommend a MacBook Pro because of battery issues. Their battery testing was incredibly inconsistent in terms of overall time. They were getting anywhere from about 19 hours all the way down to less than 4 hours in their testing. Apple's Phil Schiller commented on the unusual results and said that they were working with Consumer Reports to kind of understand the lower battery life findings. And 9to5 Mac was also kind of questioning the methodology. They reached out to them for some clarification, and after they got back to them, it seemed like the testing methodology was solid, but that still didn't sort of answer the question about where were these weird ratings coming from? Why was there so much discrepancy between the, you know, longest lasting part of the battery or longest lasting tests and these really short tests? And about the only thing they could come up with is part of the testing involved measuring the screen brightness and making sure that the screen brightness stayed at a consistent level during the tests. And 9to5 Mac concludes that, well, maybe the machine they were using for the reading on the screen brightness was having issues or defective, because they turned around and they actually replicated, this is 9to5 Mac, they replicated the test conditions that Apple uses. And in their tests, they got just over 8 hours of battery life. And in their quote unquote real life usage testing, they found that they got around 7 hours. So a little below what Apple claims they should be getting, but not nearly as bad as the less than 4 hour battery life tests that Consumer Reports found. Now, that's not to say there isn't a problem with the MacBook Pro and the battery. I've heard from owners of the new machines that are getting anywhere between 3 to 5 hours of battery life. And as a matter of fact, I heard from one MacCast listener who claims he's never gotten better than an hour and a half of battery life, which is abysmal. I'm not really sure what's going on there. If I were that user and I told him this much myself, I would get that machine right back to Apple for a replacement, because there's something wrong with that battery. Typically, most people that I'm talking to seem to be getting around 5 hours. And I think I commented on the last episode of the MacCast, you know, I have a relatively new MacBook Pro, a 2015, and I think it's rated to get 8 to 10 hours of battery life in Apple's tests. And I will tell you, honestly, I feel lucky if I get 5 to 6 hours of battery life out of it. And that's always been the case. You know, there's going to be different things going on. Apple's test conditions, you know, their battery life tests, and this is true not just for Apple, for any manufacturer of a notebook, they test in certain consistent, repeatable test conditions, and that's what the battery life is based off of. It's generally not based off of real-world usage, but certainly the new MacBook Pro should be getting just as good, if not better, battery life than previous generation models. So if that isn't happening, Apple is going to need to do some tweaking in software and potentially issue a hardware fix if it does turn out to be a hardware problem. But at this point, talking to a lot of people, looking at a lot of reviews, I'm not convinced that there is a real issue with battery life. And as a matter of fact, 9to5 Mac notes that they did a poll. They asked people, what kind of battery life are you getting? The largest percentage actually said they were getting between 6 to 9 hours. That was 38%. But a little bit concerning is that the second largest group, 37%, reported that they were getting 5 hours of battery or less with the new system. So, you know, it's kind of 50-50. So there may be some smoke to this fire. I'm not completely dismissing it. It may be that there is some sort of bad batch in the initial round, and some of these units are, you know, do have an issue. We're going to have to keep watching on this issue. So continue to give me your reports. If you have a new MacBook, what kind of battery life are you getting? Maybe we can do a little informal MacCast poll and see if we line up with the 9to5 Mac numbers. But I think based on a number of the things that I'm seeing, that overall, this is not a huge issue, if it is an issue at all. And then finally, in the news for this week, we will close out with a rumor This one, once again, comes from Sonny Dixon. I think this is the Sonny Dixon rumor show this time around. He was pretty active in the past week or so. But he is saying, and keep in mind, he tends to be fairly accurate with his leaks, although most recently I don't think he's been quite as accurate. But he says that the next version of iOS is going to have a new theater mode that will come via a popcorn icon in the control center. Now, no details were given on exactly what a theater mode in iOS is, though some speculate that it could be an iPad-centric feature. Maybe turning your iPad into a little kind of theater. That kind of harkens back in my mind back to some of the early days of the Apple TV, or what was that? What was the technology that we had? Front row technology we had in Mac OS or OS X, rather. So maybe it's something like that. Others say that it might be a silencing mode for when you're actually in a theater, which I think actually kind of makes sense. So it would disable things like system alarms, alerts, block incoming calls and vibrations from happening while you're in a theater, reduce the screen brightness. So sort of like a not necessarily an airplane mode or a do not disturb mode, but something that's specifically tuned for when you're going into a movie theater or you're going to watch a play or something like that. And, you know, there have been issues with that in the past, specifically with like alarms, which will go off even when your phone is silenced. So, Dixon was asked for clarification by 9to5 Mac, and he also speculated that it could be a new enhanced version of Apple's dark mode. So maybe even dimming the screen, again, part of this whole theater mode thing, so that when you're in the theater, you're not disturbing other people if your device is going off or something like that. And Apple does have some patents for what it describes as quote-unquote enforcement policies. But in the case of their patents, these were based on like GPS locations and were automatically activated. That actually would be pretty cool too. If your iPhone could detect, hey, you're at the movie theater, or you're at a theater, and automatically move it into this theater mode, hey, that might be pretty neat. As far as when we'll see this, Dixon says the first iOS 10.3 beta, he says codenamed Eerie, will be released with this new feature sometime in January, maybe on January 10th. So we might not have to wait that long to find out what this feature is all about, because typically when it shows up in the developer build, then we will know about it. So iOS theater mode, what do you think? With that, though, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now, I want to talk about something else entertainment related. It's not necessarily a theater mode, but it is the, I guess now, TV mode that is part of iOS and the Apple TV. The TV app I was very excited about. If you go back and listen to the MacCast where we start talking about the TV app and when Apple showed it off, when was that? Was that the special event or WWDC? All this stuff starts to merge together in my mind. Once we get to the end of the year, I have a hard time remembering where certain things were announced. But, you know, the TV app, it held such promise. It was going to be so great. And when it does work, it's, I think, somewhat okay. But I think it hasn't quite met its promise. And I think, you know, Gary is feeling that way as well. Listen to what he has to say about the TV app.
Hey, Adam, I wanted to comment on the new TV app. I have been using it in the public beta for a while, and I've noticed, you know, the slow addition to a lot of the available networks and channels, which, you know, it's slow, but it's happening. One thing that has been something I've been waiting for is HBO Go versus HBO Now. And I haven't seen it appear in, you know, I think it's the channels that are provided by your cable versus the Now, which you can, it's at the top and you can get it anytime. I'm just curious if it's probably maybe licensing. I don't know. But it's a little bit frustrating that they offer it now and not the Go to bring all that content together. The other thing that I've noticed is like Stars and forget the other channel, like maybe Showtime. I'm able to connect with them, but they ask for an additional like profile, an additional like login beyond the login for your cable company. And right now I feel like that's just too much. You know, how many things do they need from us, you know, in order to get the content that is already being paid for? It's very frustrating. So right now I did not connect with those. I just, you know, left it alone. And obviously I can't get connected with HBO Go because it's just not offered. But for the most part, the new TV app for me is interesting just to see it develop. I only really ever have used it for Hulu, which really I could get the same content that's on there on Netflix, which I'd have to leave the app and go get because they don't offer that either. And the only compelling thing that I can see there is it kind of keeps track of everything that you're watching and where your progress has been. So I find that nice, but I also think it's weird all these additional hoops that you have to go through. And I know we're pushing towards that single sign-on, but maybe how would that work with, you know, the channels like Showtime or Stars, where they're asking for, after you log in, oh, we need an additional profile to create on our network. So just a little feedback. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, Gary. You know, I don't know I have much of a response for you, but I'm hoping by playing your feedback that maybe it'll start a discussion in our community here and we'll get some more feedback from others. And I really can't answer your stuff because I am a complete cable cutter. So I have no cable, so I don't have access to a lot of those other channels and things like that. I do have HBO Now because I am a pure cable cutter. So HBO works great for me with the Apple TV app. And I'm sorry to hear, I've heard from many people who have HBO Go, which is the service that you get if you have HBO through your cable provider. It's the app that they use. I don't know why those are separate. The only thing I can think of is maybe HBO is somehow blocked by the cable providers from actually being able to integrate that with Apple. And because those of us who go direct to HBO aren't restricted like that, it's got to be something related to that. Because the cable companies want to, you know, protect their content so vigorously that I think that's why a lot of these issues and problems exist. It's probably also why you have this weird double login with things like Stars and Showtime. It's just, that's crazy. I thought with Stars and Showtime, though, you could also subscribe direct. I know you do with Hulu, so Hulu has the great integration. But then you've got things like Netflix, which I want to comment on in a little bit. But kind of getting back to the whole syncing thing and syncing your location, for me, that's one of the best features of using the new TV app, is I can start watching something on one device and then pick it right back up on another device. But unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be working for everyone. Actually, Pat wrote in to talk about her disappointment with the TV app and said that, you know, syncing was not working at all for her with the TV app. And I had her verify that she was using the same iCloud account on all your devices because it's all linked through your iCloud account. That's another area of frustration with the TV app, is if you use family sharing because the Apple TV and your iOS devices don't support multiple users, you're kind of locked into one account for all of that syncing. So, you know, in my case, my family has to just see the stuff that I'm watching. They don't, you know, get to have customization in the TV app based on the stuff that they're watching. So there's some definite holes in the TV app. But, you know, for Pat, it's not syncing the playback position on TVs or movies. And that would be really frustrating. And I don't know why that's happening. The only thing I can think of is maybe resetting, you know, logging out of iCloud and logging back into it, just like you would when you were dealing with syncing issues with contacts. But we shouldn't have to do that stuff. You know, that's the thing. So for me, being this pure cable cutter, you know, I think the lack of things like Amazon Prime. You know, I have Amazon Prime and the Amazon Prime Video app. That not being on the Apple TV at all kind of sinks, let alone being integrated, or stinks rather, let alone being integrated with the TV app. You know, that's a problem. Netflix not being supported with the new TV app feature. I think these things are huge oversights, and I really believe strongly that Apple needs to address them. Apple should be working very hard at reaching out to both Amazon and Netflix, two of the premier streaming, you know, companies, to get their stuff integrated. I don't know where the hang up is there, and they should be working to fix the HBO Go thing if they can. I mean, this is a big deal. So more channels, more content, I think are going to be key for the TV app really, you know, being that impressive thing that Tim Cook got us excited about when he talked about it. The other thing that, you know, is cool is the Apple Remote TV button now launches the TV app, and that's all well and good, but if the TV app itself isn't great, there's no point in pressing that button, right? And to me, the navigation of the app itself leaves a lot to be desired. It feels a little bit like the same navigation problems that we have with iTunes. There's a real focus on trying to sell you other stuff rather than just giving you access to your content. Yeah, it's kind of mixed in there, but it feels like there's even more of a focus in the stores section, for example, of, you know, getting me to get content from TV providers that I don't have access to, which is basically Apple trying to get me to buy more cable from my cable subscriber, or I guess subscribe to Hulu, something like that. But yeah, you know, iTunes movies and TV shows are actually buried under that stuff. And that's the stuff that I want to get to, you know, the stuff that I've purchased, the stuff that I have access to. And in that section, it's hard to navigate into. And just like in iTunes, general browsing within the TV app kind of sucks. You know, it's great for the stuff that they're trying to sort of bubble up and expose to you. You know, the things in the up next list that's like, you might like this show. You might, the recommendations, I find they're okay. But again, they're tied to channels that I may or may not have access to all of the content. They do an okay job. But if I just want to browse, if I just want to see, you know, like sci-fi movies or something like that, getting into those categories, you have to go to the category, you have to then scroll to the subcategory. You know, one thing that helps when you're doing that, when you want to find something that I discovered, is that you can tap or click the little ellipses button when you're in a category or subcategory. And then you can choose to add it. So this is when you find something. So if you're browsing and you actually find something, you can hit tap the little ellipses button on that listing and add it to your up next list. So you don't have to just watch it. You can actually throw it into your up next list, almost making it sort of like this watch wish list. And you can get content from all these different providers. So that's kind of cool, but you kind of have to manually do that. And finding and getting the stuff in the first place can be a little bit tricky, and that's not good. You know, the whole thing should be really focused on the discovery aspects, and I'm just not feeling that. It does a fairly good job, like I said, highlighting content from just the apps that are on my device, and that's good. I do wish there was a way to set the priorities of those recommendations, though, because, again, I don't have full access to, say, like CBS content, but I do have full access to CW. If you want to see a great example of a channel in an app that is awesome, it's CW. You can watch anything on the CW completely free, and I'm finding I'm watching more of those shows because they're there and they sync and they work with the app. It's really great. CBS is in there too, but it's tied to my cable subscription, and I can get access to some recent shows, but I'd like that prioritized less in my recommendations, and I wish there was a way to tweak that a little bit. There's not currently. So I guess in general, what I'm wanting from the TV app and where my disappointment falls is I want it to be smarter. Like a lot of the things that Apple is shipping now, yes, I'm looking at you, Siri. I want everything related to my Apple products and my streaming, and more specifically, I guess, my services. I want it all to be smarter. I want it to know more about me. The For You recommendations should be about me and my preferences and not just the apps and content that I have access to, not just bubbling up random stuff because, oh, you have this channel installed, let me give that to you. No, it should be tailored to what I'm watching, and I don't feel like it is right now. I don't think that Apple's leveraging all that great artificial intelligence technology and all the things that it knows about me from my iTunes purchases and things like that. That's not being factored in, or at least it doesn't feel like that to me right now. So, yeah, I'm a little bit disappointed in the TV app, and I'd love to know what others think. So what do you think? Is the TV app holding true to its promise that we thought it was going to have, or is it falling short like it seems like a lot of Apple technologies do these days? And I don't want to get negative. I'm not negative on Apple. I think the TV app shows great promise. I think there's lots of things that show great promise and can get a lot better. I'm just hoping that it happens sooner than later, I guess. And it's feeling like some of you are feeling the same way. Let's talk a little bit about networks and specifically routers and this whole mesh versus maybe Wi-Fi extenders thing. There have been some great discussions going on, particularly in light of the rumor that Apple is sort of phasing out their airport routers. A lot of people are wondering, what am I going to get to replace my airport? And there's all these great routers and technologies coming out now from various companies. Eero, who's a sponsor on this podcast, makes one of the first and really great mesh networks. There's Orbi and Amplify. There's a bunch of these new products being announced here at CES. And there's some great discussions going on related to them. This week, I found a great article, and I'll link to anything that I mention here in the show notes at MacCast.com. But Lifehacker has a great piece explaining what is mesh technology, why does it matter, why do I want it. There's some great reviews of the different products that are out on the market. The Wirecutter has one. The Mac Observer, Dave Hamilton, did an awesome review of mesh network router systems that are out there right now. But you may be wondering, okay, that's great, but what is this stuff? What is mesh, and how does it work, and why is it better than the Wi-Fi that I have? And I'm certainly no expert. I'm just learning about this stuff as well. But I'll share with you my understanding of what the technology is and how it works. I have Eero's. I'm using them. I think they're great. It's solved a lot of the problems in my home network. Specifically, the one big one it solves for a lot of people is sort of dead zones and reaching those dead spots. But, you know, how does that work? And so the idea for mesh has actually been around for a while. We've been talking about mesh networks and this idea of, you know, multiple devices sort of setting up a grid or a web, a lot of people refer to it, of coverage. And mesh networks have been used in large-scale commercial applications for a while, places like warehouses or in hospitals or office buildings or military park or military installations, you know, business applications. But they've tended to be very, very expensive, very sort of high-end things, very technical things that you need an IT staff and all kinds of technology to set up. And so that's why we really haven't seen them too much in the commercial space. But as you can see, that's changing now. And the concept here is that you use multiple access points called nodes. So you're going to have multiple routers or multiple devices, multiple nodes set up. And these nodes are going to talk to each other. They're going to communicate with each other, and they will create this web or net of coverage. So you can kind of think of them as overlapping, you know, circles. And you set up a node, and that covers a certain area. And then you set up one next to that, and that covers that area, but also touches and overlaps all the other areas. And they're all talking to each other and communicating. And as you're connected to them, you will always sort of be connected to the best node for you. And it's not just best by signal. It's actually best based on how much available bandwidth. What are you using? You know, if this node is closer to you, but there's a lot of people on there and they're streaming a lot of big, large files or videos or something like that, maybe it's better that you connect to this node over here that's a little bit further away, but still is in your coverage area, and it's probably going to give you better connectivity and speed. So they're much smarter about how you're connecting to them, and they're talking to each other, and they're analyzing the network, and they're doing all these sorts of things. So generally the way it works is that it then extends your coverage, and to extend your coverage, if you need more coverage in an area, you just add another node, and you keep adding on nodes, and you keep building out a larger and larger web. And the first node is typically is connected to your modem, and then each additional node spreads out from there, sending data back and forth, and they all are peers. They're all operating at full speed. So you're not necessarily always connected to the nearest node, but you're connected to the best node, and you can move seamlessly between nodes, and it'll kind of take care of all of that for you. So mesh really works well for areas where you need to cover a large area, or maybe you need to get around obstacles, because again, you can kind of put these things line of sight of each other. You can, you know, sort of orient them out in different ways when you have multiple ones to make sure that you move around obstacles or Wi-Fi blocking materials and things like that. You can position them so that you get the best signal between them. And typically in a mesh network, it works best for covering large areas, 2,000 square feet or larger, or in places, again, where building materials maybe block signals, or in smaller areas where maybe you can't put your Wi-Fi router in a central location. Because that's, you know, with traditional Wi-Fi, it's always best to have it kind of in the middle of the area you need to cover, because you just have one unit and sort of spreading out, and depending upon how your antennas are, you know, that's going to be your circle of coverage. With mesh, you've got multiple ones, and you're building this sort of grid out. And many of the mesh systems from companies like Eero and Netgear and Google and others, another advantage of them is there's an aesthetic advantage. They tend to be smaller. They're typically, you know, nicer looking than your typical, say, Wi-Fi extender, because with traditional Wi-Fi, a way you often get around this is through an extender. And we'll talk a little bit here about how extenders are different. But just in general, you know, mesh networks, they're much easier to set up and manage. It's all kind of handled for you. They have apps and software for your mobile devices that help you position everything and get everything set up. Many of the tools let them self-update and self-manage. Like I said, it's going to kind of keep track. They all communicate with each other, and you can get alerted to problems or issues directly. The main disadvantage of mesh, if you can actually call it a disadvantage, is cost. They tend to be a little bit more expensive than a good quality high-end router. But if you have a high-end router and you start to have to add other Wi-Fi extenders, you have that adding to the costs, and also the additional hassles of Wi-Fi networks tend to be more complex to set up. And Wi-Fi extenders, they're not exact peers, right? You're splitting up wireless signals. Yeah, they're getting more that have multiple antennas and kind of handle this stuff. But, you know, a mesh network might be worth the extra upfront investment because you don't have the hassles and you're not going to have kind of these dead zones and things like that. So it takes care of a lot of problems. So you're paying a little more upfront, but again, a lot of times you're getting what you pay for. Now let's talk a little bit about, you know, Wi-Fi extenders, because that is an option, right? If you have a traditional router and you just need to reach one area of your house, maybe a Wi-Fi extender is the better way to go. The way it works is it connects to your current Wi-Fi network and it rebroadcasts the signal. It basically becomes this little separate access point. And you can set up many of them to use the same SSID, but sometimes you can run into issues with that. So one of the advantages of mesh networks is you really just have one network that's extended out. You can kind of simulate that with a Wi-Fi extender by giving it the same network name, but laptops and mobile devices moving through that network with a Wi-Fi extender won't always connect and automatically switch to the best access point. So a lot of times the way people get around that is they give their extender a different name, and that way you can know, okay, I'm still connected way back to that weak signal. I want to connect to this closer one, and you can switch manually, but that then becomes a hassle. You can't just move around your network. So that really works if, say, you have a device that's not going to move around, like a static desktop machine or maybe an Apple TV. You could set up a separate network for that zone to kind of cover that area and just know, okay, the Apple TV is always going to be connected to the extender, and my iOS device is going to be connected to the main network. And if I'm getting a bad signal, I can manually switch over. But, you know, if you have phones and tablets that are moving around your network, that might not be the best thing. The advantage to range extenders is they are less expensive. They're about half the cost of a traditional mesh network node unit. So you may save a little bit of money, but again, you have to kind of think, is it really worth the hassle? And I will throw out a mention to say, you know, hardwiring, if you can do it, it's always the best option. You know, if you can run Cat 6 cable everywhere you need and, you know, plug in your devices directly, more power to you. But for mobile devices, that's not really realistic. Of course, you know, with hardwiring, you could set up multiple zones so you could get multiple routers and put them in different areas to provide different areas of coverage. That works great. I actually did that for a while. I used power line adapters and connected, you know, I had my main base station and then bridged that using power line to an airport express to cover one area of my house where I had a hard time reaching. And that worked really great and for a while. But again, it was kind of tricky to set up and you had to manage it and keep track of it. And so mesh really kind of solves some of those issues. Few other tops, you know, thoughts and tips. If you're not going to go with a new mesh network solution, one way to get better coverage is to, again, move your main router to a central location and know that putting it up higher, if you can, if you're in a multi-story house, locating it in the center of the house up on an upper story, Wi-Fi signals seem to travel down better than they do up. So don't put it in your basement and try and get it up to the, you know, second or third floor. Actually put it up higher and let it go down. And then keep your router away from solid walls like stone and brick. You know, don't surround them with that. Don't surround them with metal. Keep them away from metal surfaces if you can. And this is where, you know, some of the mesh systems that look a little bit better, have a little better aesthetic, may help some nerds out there. You know, your spouse may or may not like the look of your technical gear. So if it's a little bit prettier, you can get away with maybe putting it in the center of the room on a coffee table or, you know, a bookshelf maybe behind the couch or something like that. If it's ugly, they're going to want it tucked away in the corner or put somewhere where someone can't see it. So, you know, avoid being near walls and things like that. Other things that may interfere with the signals, don't put it next to your microwave. That's probably one of the worst places you can put it because that will interfere with the signals. And then this was something I learned. If your router does have antennas, if you position the antennas upward, it's going to be better for the signals going out horizontally. If you need to go vertically, so again, this would, I would imagine, be the situation where you've got to go down through a couple floors, orient the antennas vertically, or sideways, horizontally rather, to have the signals travel more vertically. That makes sense. I think I got that right. So a couple little tips there if you're sticking with that. Or, you know, again, maybe consider some of these new mesh systems. And like I said, there's a lot of options out there. Most of them are very good. Check out those reviews that I mentioned earlier, and that should help you make buying decisions. And of course, if you have any additional questions, things like that, you're always welcome to email me here at the MacCast, maccast@gmail.com. And if you have anything to add to this conversation, tips, tricks, personal opinions, personal experiences, please share those with us as well. And you can send those to the same email address. Now, AirPods. I've been hearing some various tips on dealing with lost and or stolen AirPods. And I'll just comment, you know, with my AirPods, I've actually managed to misplace mine a couple times. I've had no issues with losing an individual AirPod, though. A number of people, you know, early on when AirPods were announced said, oh, you know, people are going to lose, they're going to pop out, you're going to lose an AirPod. And I've heard some of that. But personally, my issue has been with actually losing the whole charging case with the AirPods in it. I'll put it down and I will forget where it's gone. Actually, one time I set it on the seat of my car and I think going around a corner, it slipped and slid down between the seat. So I've misplaced mine, and I don't know that I have a good answer for finding the charging case. I'm going to give you some tips in a little bit here on actually finding individual AirPods. But again, I've never really dropped mine. I did drop my AirPod one time when I was attempting to remove it from the case. And I will comment, and I don't remember in my review if I mentioned this, those things are kind of hard to get out of the charging case, or at least I have a hard time with them. You kind of have to pinch the, you know, front part where the speaker grill is and kind of the back of it. But because of the material, it's slippery. And in the charging case, there's magnets that suck it down into the charging area. So you have to pull up with a little bit of force. And the darn thing's slippery. So when you just have your thumb and forefinger on it, it can pop out. And I've managed to drop it when taking it out of the case. But no big deal. It just dropped on the floor. It didn't, you know, fall anywhere or go anywhere where I couldn't just pick it back up. I would imagine, though, you know, you're out in the snow. I think this happened to Renee Ritchie. He had a hard time finding it. But the answer to that seems to be, and the one tip that I've heard for finding a dropped or misplaced AirPod is to just go to the music player, crank up the music, and listen. You know, hopefully you're in a quiet environment and you can hear it playing, because you can hear the sound pretty good when they're cranked up to 100% when it's just in a quiet room. I tested this and I was able to locate an AirPod that way. So that's one tip. Another tip is to use it, you know, use the last device that you had it paired with like a poor man's sort of GPS locator. So what you can do is you can, with one AirPod in the charging case, if you have one, or if you've lost both, I guess, use the charging case and or your iOS device that was last paired with it, and walk around with the battery widget open. So go to the notification center over to the widgets and get the battery widget up. And if you're not near the AirPod, then you won't see them show up, you know, in the battery indicators. But as you get closer, it will pop up into the battery indicator. And as a matter of fact, I received a story from a listener who wants to remain anonymous, who mentioned a issue he had with having an AirPod stolen on an airplane flight. What happened was he dropped his left EarPod while taking it out of the case, or AirPod rather, while taking it out of the case on the plane, dropped between the seat. He asked around, asked the guys behind him, have you seen this AirPod? They said no. They kind of looked around underneath the seats and in different areas, and nope, it wasn't there. Couldn't find it. So he kind of let it go, finished the flight, and decided, what I'll do is I'll wait around on the plane after the plane clears and just look around and see if I can find the missing AirPod. And lo and behold, what he discovered was, as he was looking for it, he looked in the battery widget and noticed, oh, the AirPod's gone. That left AirPod is not showing up at all. And he realized, okay, the guys in the seat behind him must have taken it. So he ran outside, he looked around, and luckily he found them outside the airport waiting on a car, and just casually strode up behind him. And sure enough, the AirPod appeared in the battery indicator. So he knew these guys had it, and he confronted him. I don't know if this is anything that I would recommend that you do, but he confronted him and said, hey, I know you have my AirPod, and guess what? One of the guys magically found it inside his backpack. He didn't know how it got there. It must have just, you know, slipped in magically and returned it. And so luckily it went without incident this time. Remember, you can replace a single AirPod from Apple. It'll cost you $79 US. So even if you had one stolen or you lost one, I'm also kind of curious what the guy planned to do with one single AirPod and no battery case. A little bit puzzling. But anyway, there's that. Now, if you want to prevent theft, there's actually a creative way that showed up online. I think over on an Etsy store, someone is actually making labels for the AirPod case that makes them look like dental floss. Many people have commented that the case, and I agree with this wholeheartedly, it looks like a dental floss case. So you could, you know, either design your own or buy a commercial one and print out a little sticky label that makes it look like dental floss. So when it's sitting out there in plain sight, you know, hide it in plain sight. No one will know that it's your it's your AirPods, or at least if they don't listen to this podcast, they won't know. And then one other thing that I found related to AirPods and finding them if you should lose one is there's actually a new app. It's called Finder for AirPods, and I was a little bit dubious of this. It's $4, $3.99 US on the App Store. And the first time I tried it out, I thought it worked okay. It didn't seem to be much more useful than using the tip that I mentioned earlier where I said, just open up the battery widget and look for it. That'll get you in the general area, and then you can kind of look around for where the AirPod might be. And I thought that at first, but then I thought, let me go back and test this again. So I gave each of my kids one of my AirPods, and I said, hide this in the house, and then I'm going to use the app to see if I can find the AirPods. And it miraculously worked. So when you launch the app, it walks you through a little wizard, and it says, okay, do you have, which AirPod is missing, or are they both missing? And you tell it, and then it gives you some instructions for, opening the battery case, putting the AirPod in, and then you walk around and it has a little black bar indicator. And as you get closer to the AirPod or where the AirPod is, that little black bar will get larger and larger and larger. And when it's almost full, then you're almost on top of or you're very near the AirPod. And I guess what I didn't understand the first time I used it was it goes through this message where it says you're getting closer, it's around here. It kind of gives you some text on the screen. The text isn't very helpful because the minute I opened it up, even when I was far away from it, it said, oh, you're getting warmer. Well, I wasn't even close. But as I watched the bar, that's what really helped get me in the general area. And then I was able to find these pretty well hidden AirPods using just the app. So I can recommend it. The only disadvantage is that you have to have the case. It only works for finding the individual earbuds or AirPods. I'm probably mispronouncing it or missaying the name, and I apologize for that. I'm probably interchanging. I can tell throughout this story that I'm interchanging EarPod and AirPod. Very close together. Yes, they're AirPods. So finding individual AirPods, the Finder for AirPods does work and may be worth the $4 if you've misplaced yours. Of course, they need to have a charge on them too, so you're going to have to activate the app while the devices are still charged. And one final note that I want to talk about with the AirPods, I've already mentioned I absolutely love them. I was concerned that the price of these things, they are pretty pricey for what you get, but I'm really, really enjoying them. I wish they were a little bit cheaper, but there you go. The only complaint that I have so far, one of the biggest complaints that I think I have so far, is the Siri functionality. And I'm throwing this out halfway because I'm hoping someone will give me a tip and say, Adam, no, you're just doing it wrong. And maybe I am. But I have had a hard time doing the double tap gesture and actually activating Siri. And I think part of the problem is that there's really no visual interaction. So you double tap and then you're kind of waiting. Is Siri going to activate? Is Siri not going to activate? And for me, half the time, I hear the Siri chime and then I can do my command. So I have not had luck, a lot of luck with Siri. I get it to work about maybe 2/3 of the time. And maybe that's okay. I don't know. But one thing that I wanted to mention was something that Mark discovered. He emailed me and said he wasn't having any luck using the Siri feature at all. And he contacted Apple support. And what he discovered was, or what they told him was, well, Siri, if you have in the Siri settings on your iOS device, the access when locked feature turned off, yeah, you can't use the double tap Siri feature with your AirPods because at least while the device is on the lock screen because you can't access Siri from the lock screen. So you have to unlock it, unlock the device, and then use Siri, which kind of defeats the whole purpose. So just be aware of that if you're trying to use Siri and you have the access when locked feature turned off, you may want to turn that back on. Of course, that opens up some other security and privacy concerns for some people. So you're going to have to kind of judge, is it worth gaining the AirPod functionality and losing maybe a little bit of security and privacy, or do you want to stick with that and just deal with the hassle of I'm going to have to unlock my device before I can actually use the Siri feature of my AirPods? Another thing to note, and I guess another one of my little complaints about the AirPods, is Hey Siri as a listening feature does not work through the AirPods. It has to go through your phone. So if your phone is in your pocket, you can't really use that functionality. And I understand why that is. You know, the AirPods don't have a huge battery, so to have the microphones on all the time and listening would probably run down the battery too fast. But it would have been great if Apple, and maybe in future version of the AirPods, Apple will be able to do it. It'd be great if the Hey Siri functionality could work through the AirPod mic. But for now, the double tap gesture that I can't seem to do is the only way to activate that. So that's just some additional tips for finding lost or stolen AirPods and a few other AirPod comments for you. And then finally for today, I want to make some comments and maybe help out listener Justin, who wrote in to mention that he's been doing a job where he's having to travel internationally more frequently. And this has caused a little bit of trouble for him with his iCloud account. And specifically, what he's been noticing is that when he travels internationally and goes to a new hotel and connects to their Wi-Fi, he's able to use his Mac and devices for a bit, and then at some point, probably when the iCloud services in the background kick in to do a sync or something like that, he gets alerted with a message saying, your iCloud account has been locked for security reasons. And he was wondering, one, why is this happening? And then two, he was having trouble because he uses two-factor authentication and he was getting stuck in this sort of login loop. So I did a little poking around, Justin, and I couldn't find a definitive, you know, version of what's happening. But Justin speculated, and I tend to agree with him, that what might be going on is because he's accessing iCloud suddenly from a completely different country than he normally is in, some sort of security feature is kicking on with Apple and iCloud. And I think that's probably the case. I think if you move, you know, I think they're using GeoIP, geolocation IP addresses, and figuring out, okay, you just connected this morning, you know, at home, and now suddenly you're connecting from France or from really far away, wherever you might be. And it's kicking in the security feature. But the problem becomes that Justin is using two-factor authentication, and he's also using a local SIM. So when he gets to the country, the other thing that he's doing is he's taking his standard SIM out of his phone, putting in a new local regional SIM. So his phone now doesn't have the same phone number. He's got a local phone number. And with two-factor authentication turned on, the unlock procedure involves getting the alert message, and then you have to have a verified or a trusted device. And one of the ways that you get unlocked is to send a text message to that phone or trusted device. And because Justin's phone number has changed, obviously he can't get that text message. So now he can't log in, he can't unlock his account, he can't access iCloud. And so that's where this problem comes in. Now, it should work via an iMessage notification or a message notification based on the iCloud account and email. But I guess because the account is locked, in Justin's case, that's not quite working. I couldn't quite figure out why, Justin, you couldn't get that message, you know, just because your phone number had changed. And I looked, Apple actually has a support article, a support page on what to do if your Apple ID is locked. I'll link to that in the show notes. Maybe that'll be helpful. But it did have some specific comments on what to do with two-factor authentication turned on. And to explain this, there's, you know, a couple different options for verifying. You have your trusted devices, which would be an iPhone, an iPad, an iPod Touch running iOS 9 or later, or a Mac with El Capitan or later. And any one of these, if you've already signed in and you're using two-factor authentication on that device, it should be set up as a trusted device, and you should be able to get the code the unlock information on that device without a text message. So I don't know if all your devices are set up as trusted devices. You can actually log into your account, your Apple ID account at appleid.apple.com, and you can view which devices are set up as trusted devices on your account. So you may want to verify that your Mac and all your other devices are set up as trusted devices. Now, you can also, with two-factor authentication, use a trusted phone number. And that would be a phone number of a device that you have, your iPhone, that can receive verification codes via a text or a phone call. And I have a feeling that's what's happening for you, is you're getting into the trusted phone number area. And obviously, because you've swapped out SIMs, that's not working for you. Well, the good news is that there actually is a way to get the unlock code, the verification code, on your device without actually going through the prompts. You can actually get it right from one of your trusted devices itself. So if you get stuck in this loop again, here's something you might try. If you go into view your iCloud settings on the device, so go into settings on your iPhone or iPad and go under iCloud, and then tap on your iCloud username, your Apple ID username. And if your device is offline or asking for this code, you can tap get verification code. If your device is online, you can tap password and security and then tap get verification code. And that will pop up and give you the verification code that you can then use to log into your iCloud account or activate your iCloud account on your other device. If you're on your Mac running El Capitan or later, you can go into the Apple menu, go to System Preferences, again, go to iCloud, click on Account Details, and it's the same thing. If the device is offline, click the Get Verification Code option. If it's online, click Password and Security, and then click Get Verification Code. And then you should be able to get a verification code on your Mac. And then you can, once again, use that code to enter into the little box, and that should get you logged back into your account. If you get completely logged out of your account, you can try going through Apple's website, the appleid.apple.com, see if you can clean things up there. And if all of that fails, if all else fails, you're probably going to have to contact Apple support and see if they can't help you out. But certainly sounds like a frustrating situation. Maybe some other people in our community we'll have an answer for you, Justin, that's better than mine. If you do, shoot us a comment, send us an email, maccast@gmail.com. The reality is I don't do any international traveling. I don't think, you know, besides Canada and Mexico on occasion, I've never been out of the country. I know, sad. I hope to someday, hoping to get over to Europe sometime in the next year or two, UK specifically, and, until then, I guess, you know, I have to rely on all of you to tell me how this stuff works when you're traveling internationally. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I do, I kind of teased this at the top of the show. I do want to let you know, if you want a set of AirPods, it turns out, you know, if you heard the last episode of the MacCast, you heard my adventure for going to get some AirPods because I was worried I wasn't going to get them until mid-January, and I wanted to be able to talk about them and review them for you. I hunted a pair down. I went on an adventure to get them, but I still had a set on order. And the set that I actually had on order showed up early, right after Christmas on the 28th. So I have in my hand right now a sealed, brand new, in-the-box set of Apple AirPods. And sure, I could return them, but I thought what would be better would be to give them away to one of you, one of the devoted members of our MacCast community. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to give these things away, but you're going to have to do a little bit of work. You're going to have to be a MacCast listener. You need to listen to the show, and I would tell your friends to subscribe too if they want a chance to win. And for the next three episodes, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give out a secret word on each of the next three episodes. And when you have all three words, I will set up an entry form. I'll give you the URL. I'll tell you all about it when I tell you the third secret word. and then you will be able to enter. And to enter, you will have to tell me the three secret words and fill out the form, and you will be entered in for your chance to win a set of Apple AirPods. So just submit the three secret words correctly to enter, and it will be limited to one entry per person. After that time, I will pick and announce a winner probably sometime in February, and it should be a lot of fun. So the secret word for the AirPod giveaway for this week is Mr. T. Mr. T. M-R-T. And if you're wondering where these words are coming from, they are the code names for different Macs that I've owned in my lifetime. So if you want to know which one is Mr. T, you're going to have to do some Googling, and you can figure out which Mac was actually my first Mac. And I will be sharing two other secret words on the next two episodes of the MacCast for your chance to win a set of AirPods. So it should be a lot of fun. But for now, that'll do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you are always welcome to send me emails and audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you'd like to follow me between shows, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you're on Google Plus, you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community. You'll find that at google.com/plusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.